Hello, everyone, and welcome to Energy Security Cubed. I am your host, CEO, and president of the Canadian Global Affairs Institute, Kelly Ogle. On today's episode, recorded November 11th, and actually at the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month, I'll just remind everyone that it is Remembrance Day and Veterans Day in America. Today, we're going to look at the relationship between energy security in Canada and energy security in the United States. To talk on this subject today, we are joined, very excited about this, from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, by energy expert Jude Clemente. Jude is a principal of JTC Energy Research Associates, LLC, and a frequent energy commentator, having published over 400 energy-related pieces in a variety of outlets, including Forbes magazine. Jude has also contributed to reports for multiple major energy research organizations, including the International Energy Administration. Welcome, Jude. We're happy to have you.
Hey, thank you for having me today. Pleasure to be with you.
Let's roll right into it. A couple of kind of key words in my own discussions about energy security, especially from a North American focus. Energy security in Canada is interdependent, independent, or somewhere in between when you discuss energy security in the United States.
I think that's true. I think, you know, what's really happening here is a critical relationship has emerged between the U.S. and Canada. And we even know the U.S., namely for oil and gas and electricity, hydropower. And one thing that's happened, as everybody knows, since 2008, the U.S. has had this giant shale revolution. We're producing a ton more oil and gas. Well, guess what's happened is our imports, especially for oil, for Canada, have actually surged as well. And that has displaced imports that we would get from OPEC. So we basically took OPEC, reduced what we were getting oil-wise from OPEC, and put it in Mexico, because Mexico has declining production. And we've substituted that with energy coming in from a friend, a neighbor, and an ally, Canada. So our energy security has skyrocketed, as far as I'm concerned, due to that emerging and really growing relationship.
How do we continue to foster that and you know, get that message out there? I think that, as you and I have discussed in the past, I think the energy, let's quote, awareness, unquote, in Canada would be better than the United States. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. I always use this, and it's an embarrassment to say, but there's been polling where 1 in 4 Americans still think that the sun revolves around the earth. So that's just a simple example. I think there's a lot of misunderstanding here in the U.S. on energy. And a perfect example is oil, the importance of oil, the importance of a relationship with Canada. Oil has no large-scale substitute. So when you talk about wind and you talk about solar, yes, we want renewable energy, but the bottom line is those are sources of electricity. They are not going to displace oil usage, which, by the way, oil and gas supplies about 70% of U.S. energy. Wind and solar are closer to 4%. So I think that gets mixed, where you see a wind farm and a solar plant and you think that's reducing oil usage. It's not. What could is electric cars, absolutely, but those are a little more expensive and a little more inconvenient to use. So this emerging, really burgeoning relationship we've had with Canada for the past 10 years for oil and gas has absolutely been critical to energy security. And my goal would be, my wife's actually from Guadalajara, Mexico, would to be bring in Mexico into that and get a North American energy alliance. When you see Russia dealing with China, India dealing with Iran, we absolutely need a North American energy alliance on all fronts, electricity, oil and gas, and renewable energy as well.
Well, that's a great place to segue into the next question, because major projects are, you know, especially energy infrastructure projects, are really in the crosshairs of all of analysts, from the farthest to the left, I'm going to say, use that loosely, green advocates of renewable energy and the more traditional forms. And I like your point about a North American schematic, because one of Canada's great companies, TC Energy, is a giant player in the Mexican energy sphere with natural gas transmission systems and bilateral relationship with the United States. And I think that, let's expand on that. Other projects, well, and the one, you know, the elephant in the room, Jude, the KXL pipeline. Where do you think this is? What could we say about that today, given the president-elect, et cetera?
Yeah, he hasn't mentioned too much on Keystone. I know the industry is pushing infrastructure development that has bipartisan support, manufacturing that has bipartisan support. But the thing about Keystone that I like is it does establish this connection with Canada. And the bottom line is, you know, Canada has a great chance to export oil and gas. And the problem that I would have if it would go to China, they actually have less environmental regulations than the U.S. does. So if somebody's going to use the oil coming out of Canada, it would be better for the U.S. to use that oil, so to speak. But and I do think a lot of the oil and gas industry is getting cleaner with methane regulations potentially coming. You know, it's a constant evolution. And we've seen this with fracking in general. Don't underestimate the ability of these industries to continually clean up themselves. And we're seeing this with LNG. There's now net zero LNG cargoes, which who would have thought that? So I don't like the idea of picking winners and losers. I like the idea of setting goals, setting standards, of course. But the reality is oil is nowhere near replaceable at scale globally, not just in the U.S.
That's a really good point. And I would encourage our listeners to go back to the last podcast that we published with Richard Norris from London, England, about the misnomers around the destruction of oil demand in the future. And, you know, this is exactly what Jude's pointing out, is that, you know, it's just not going to fall off a cliff. And so much of the future of any kind of energy strategy has to, or security strategy has to involve crude oil, at least in the next several decades. Another point that I'd like you to discuss, let's go a little deeper, is the whole shale revolution is a bad term, but gas and oil in the United States changed the world dynamic. And could you comment on the fact that, you know, although the U.S., especially energy oil shale revolution was dramatic, there's not a lot of retained earnings have been created in those oil shale producers. And I see last week where there's a kerfuffle about methane contained in U.S. cargoes that could go to Europe comes from production in Texas that's got bad methane emissions, and there's some pushback there. Could you comment on that? Because I feel that Canada is on the cutting edge, and much as we get bad press, we are the best at containing solution gas. Could you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And that is a problem. I mean, there's no question about it. The methane emissions in, especially in Texas, that's a really big deal. That area needs more pipelines so they don't have to flare gas. And methane reduction actually has bipartisan support. The late John McCain, speaking of Veterans Day, was very big on stopping these emissions because methane is a product. It's natural gas. So there's a natural incentive to want to stop these fugitive leaks that come out because you're losing product. It's like the BP spill back in 2010. Everybody was all over BP. They're doing all they can to stop those spills. They lost market, you know, tens of billions of dollars in market cap, you know, just because of the spill. So reducing methane is critical. And I think it's part of this sustainability that the industry is trying to install. But the French situation with Engie, I think that was a little politics behind that, to be honest with you, because if you have that philosophy where you're worried about emissions with your trade partners, then you can't really do any trade with Russia or China, which obviously has way worse emissions. So it's a little bit of politicking there, no doubt about it. And I think that had a little bit to do with President Trump pulling us out of the Paris Accords. And now President-elect Biden looks like he's going to get us back into it. I do think that was a little politics, but point well taken. The industry and investment banks are pushing back as well. One of the key factors is to reduce these methane emissions. And Canada's, like you said, has been on it too. These are the best scientists in the world, the best engineers in the world. I do think there's a chance that, you know, we can make this situation much better.
Talking about bipartisan support, what do you think that President-elect Biden, if he's confirmed in January, which I think, you know, most people would contend that will happen. Well, can you give us a broad brush understanding, as best you can, of what Biden's energy security paradigm would mean for Canada?
Okay, well, first off, I think there is support for transmission lines. So that's bipartisan support. That's going to be part of the infrastructure package. The bottom line is you need transmission lines to get some of this cleaner energy to the population centers. That's a big deal up in the U.S. Northeast, getting hydro power from, what's it, Hydro Quebec, the utility up there. So that's a possibility to help there. More transmission lines connecting the U.S. and Canada. The bottom line is Canada, of course, is a huge hydropower powerhouse with Brazil. So there's opportunities there, I think. And that's something that never gets mentioned. You talk about wind and solar. What about hydro? Hydro is actually 99% of our backup, talk about storage situation for wind and solar, comes from hydro, from pumped hydro. So what are the options behind that? Batteries still have a long way to go, but I would see it transmission lines being a key. I do think oil and gas is going to remain essential. I don't think the Biden administration has any incentive to necessarily go against that right now publicly. So they're not saying a lot, and they've taken this approach with LNG. LNG could actually be under a better position with the Biden administration because they could lower trade tensions with China. So that's another option as well. But a lot of what we would do with Canada, I do think, would be centered on transmission lines, some oil. But I think there's a lot of gas opportunities because a lot of the areas that get gas from Canada are far removed from the shale revolution or whatever you want to call it. A lot of the areas there, especially in the upper Midwest to the West, those areas in the U.S. need Canadian gas.
I'm going to circle around here a little bit, Jude, about, President-elect Biden particularly is from Pennsylvania. And, the center of the giant gas jump in the United States, Pennsylvania, is right in the center of that. And he's been pretty cognizant of how important that is to the country. And I think that it could be claimed that natural gas is really there's enough people state that natural gas is the bridge to renewables in the future. Do you want to speak a bit about U.S. gas supply and LNG and how that might relate to Canadian LNG?
Sure. Yeah, there's absolutely no question about it. I mean, to me, natural gas, all you have to do is look at the states and even the countries that have done all they can to only install wind and solar in renewables. California, Germany, they still use a ton of gas, so much so that Germany is looking at building LNG import facilities, namely to back up wind and solar power that are naturally intermittent. But I do think, looking forward, I think that's very telling that a lot of these countries are still looking at using a lot of gas along with renewables. But the export thing here in the U.S. and also in Canada, I think they need to come at this as on the moral high ground. I really believe that. And I say that because natural gas is a modern fuel. It's a reliable fuel. It's a clean fuel. And a lot of these Asian countries, China, India, they're overwhelmingly coal-based. So natural gas can help reduce emissions. It can bring modern energy to a overly deprived, a sadly energy-deprived world. We're 6 in every 7 humans. And we forget this when you live in Toronto and Pittsburgh and San Francisco. You forget these things. 6 in every 7 humans live in still developing countries, non-OECD. They need all the energy they could get. Over 3 billion humans still live on biomass. That's unacceptable to me. And Canada has a great chance, LNG Canada on the Western coast. First of all, you're closer to Asia than the Gulf Coast is here in the U.S. So the transport costs are lower. You can get there faster, so it makes it cheaper. And you have a ton of supply. And also, remember, Canada doesn't have growing needs as far as a population, slow growth population, where a country like Mexico has huge incremental needs because a lot of it's energy deprived. Canada is the developed, fully developed nation that, maybe categorized as slowly growing, even declining in some areas. So I think Canada has a huge chance to export a modern fuel in gas to reduce emissions in Asia. And if you look at the International Energy Agency, they have specifically cited the U.S. use of natural gas as why we are cutting carbon emissions faster than any other country in the history of energy, because we're using more gas. That's not my words. That's the words of the International Energy Agency, or the advisor of the 38 OECD nations. So it's a moral issue. To me, it's absolutely the moral high ground. is exporting a modern fuel to a poor world. I think the only solar, only wind paradigm is not just hypocritical, it's absolutely unfair, and it's only going to work to keep poor people poor.
So I completely agree, but I'm going to ask you a hard question here. Like, because you're absolutely right. Those that jump up and down about not having natural gas to feed your stove in your restaurant or your house need to understand that, like, you, not only a billion people still cook their food over cow dung. Let's cut to the chase here. So now, having said that, you know, generally Democratic leadership in the United States are bigger on subsidies, bigger on you know, help, you know, I'm going to give you a hand because I'm from the government. And that plays, sorry to be caustic, but plays right into the hands of renewables such as wind and solar, because at this point, there's no economics in them. It's a not a zero-sum game, it's a negative game. So how, as commentators, can you, me, the greater understanding of energy, how can we help message this such that we can be better proponents of all of the above? I get it. There's places in the world that solar and wind are can generally add to the mix, but we seem to have a hard time as commentators, and especially the energy industry, they're notoriously bad for not talking about the whole thing. What's going to happen here in the United States with renewables?
Yeah, well, they're right. The oil and gas industry is afraid to promote itself. I mean, there's no question about that. And my theory on that is they know oil's irreplaceable. It can't be replaced at scale anytime soon. And gas is really the go-to fuel. We're seeing this even in, I use California. I lived in San Diego for 8 years. So I know the California market very well. Even California, who has less electricity needs because of mild weather, is still using a ton of gas. We saw the blackouts that happened back in September. And then, guess what? All of a sudden, California is planning to keep 4 to 5 gas plants online because they need them when this at night when there's no sun and there's no when the times when there's no wind. But one of the things too, and you mentioned taxes, I think that is actually bipartisan. I think wind and solar has bipartisan production tax support. If you look at Texas, the GOP state, easily the wind power leader in the US, and a lot of it is site specific. So yes, there's a lot of wind power in the Midwest. I mean, everybody knows that. But if you get down to the Southeast region, there's not a lot of, that's why they don't have renewable portfolio standards in the Southeast, because they don't have a good wind resource. So not every area is the same, and California promotes itself as a solar example. Well, no question it is, but not, like I said, I lived in San Diego. I guarantee you, it is obviously a lot of these cities and areas, no, they don't have the solar resource that some of these other places go. So there's sweet spots for wind and solar, I think, that sometimes gets ignored. And that's where gas comes in to be that sort of backup fuel, because all you need is really a pipeline, which are getting harder to build. I mean, by the way, no question. But I think there's a sweet spot reality that needs to be accepted. Not every place is the same. We've seen this in Germany trying to do solar. It isn't a great fit. So I think that's the reality check.
One thing that is probably, it is the topic of the day, is the Biden potential administration. And can you comment a bit about offshore wind and the Biden administration? Because I know that they've discussed the, one of his planks is the reduction of any kind of energy exploration on federal lands. Can you speak a bit about offshore wind in the United States?
Sure. Yeah, no question. A lot of that is the Northeast offshore wind. Now, to be frank with you, I see that as a little bit of a niche market. I don't think it has quite the takeoff ability as some think. I think that there are higher costs to it. No question about that. They get hard to be built. There are actually environmental groups. There are fishing groups in New England that are against offshore wind because it changes the migration habits of fish, basically, in offshore sea life. So there's a pushback on that. But I think it's generally a higher cost outlook. I mean, if you saw the Trump administration blocking offshore oil and gas development down in the Southeast, that actually included offshore wind. So the Biden administration might try to change that, where they block offshore oil and gas development, but they allow it for offshore wind. And if you look at the projections from the Department of Energy, there's two things that are stagnant, increasingly stagnant. Every year they do a projection, it's stagnant. Nuclear is always stagnant in any of their projections for electricity in this country in the coming decades, and offshore wind is always stagnant, maybe slightly increasing. So I have not seen a projection from the Department of Energy indicating any sort of a major shift in offshore wind, but it's definitely a growing field. All these renewables are growing fields, but that doesn't mean that they're going to be taking over the energy complex within, you know, years, as you said, decades. That's probably true. There's just physical and cost realities to them that unfortunately continually go ignored.
So I want to come back to the shale. I know that you're well versed in U.S. shale, and this is more kind of a business question, but, you know, the never-ending treadmill of trying to produce shale oil has its has its challenges. And where do you see the future of U.S. internal, the lower 48 oil production in the next, say, half a dozen years or decade, considering the fact that, you know, the big companies, Exxon, BP, and in Canada, the Cenovus, Imperial Oil, they're discussing, you know, this zero net emissions in 2050. Pretty hard for these mid-sized companies to fit into that schematic, in my opinion. Can you comment on that?
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And if you look at some of the giants companies, as you mentioned, they're actually very pro some of these regulations because it would hurt their competitors, which is those smaller companies that can't afford some of these regulations. But as I see it, I see in Western Canada, we've already seen this, and we're seeing it down in Texas. We're seeing a consolidation in the industry. So you're seeing a lot of these deep-pocketed majors starting to buy, and they've been doing it for a while. You know, it's an off and on thing, no question, the consolidation. But we've seen this in the past month or two with Chevron buying Noble, ConocoPhillips buying Contra Resources. So some of these giants are buying some of these quote-unquote smaller firms as far as consolidating the industry. It's been a rough ride this year for everybody, every industry across the board. So I think that's a positive sign overall is consolidation. A lot of these bigger, deeper pocketed companies can, you know, they can sort of weather the storm and buy some of the smaller technically expertise companies. I think that's a good thing. But you're right. These companies aren't making a ton of money. That's been the complaint for a while. But production continues to go up other than this year. And they've probably have overproduced. I think that is a fair statement. But I don't see... I see U.S. gas production continually increasing, and I see U.S. crude production slightly going up, maybe a little bit over the next couple of years, six, 8 years, maybe flatlining, maybe pulling back a little bit, but certainly not plummeting. But I don't see it skyrocketing like it has since 2008, when we've increased production 160%. I think that's over with. I do think a slight increase is a fair assessment. Potentially.
So yeah, that, you know, you get down to the existential discussion and, you know, the NOCs, national oil companies that produce crude oil at zero cost to capital other than the social costs in a country like Saudi Arabia or the Emirates or et cetera. But I agree that the consolidations will continue and perhaps the smaller independents are the ones where the technological breakthroughs come, but that will come to an end too. I hate to sound like a socialist, but I think that this is a necessity of consolidation to capture the reserve and resource in a timely manner is certainly going to happen. And there's no question that it's, especially on the oil space, the gas space. Can you elaborate a little bit more about where I'm a bit unfamiliar with the big gas producers in the United States other than the majors. So what's happening in places like Pennsylvania and Ohio and in that space as far as expansion, how is that where the big gas increases are going to come from? I know you wrote about this a couple of days ago, and I haven't had a chance to look at that.
Yeah, you're right. Well, in Pittsburgh, the largest gas producer in the country is actually a company called EQT. They're based, I can almost see their office from my house. They're right downtown Pittsburgh, and they're looking at buying acreage. So a lot of this, and remember, in Appalachia, where I'm at, Ohio, West Virginia, Pennsylvania, it's about gas. If you get down to Texas, it's about oil and gas. In my area, it's about gas. We don't get a lot of crude oil here. You get some gas liquids. But this year, it's been a flat line here in my area. You know, a lot of these companies, they don't have a lot of incentive to bring on new production. We've had the lowest gas prices in the U.S. since 1989. in the areas around here, they need more pipelines because the prices are so low that you get a glut overall. So that's an issue. And that's a problem with building pipelines is becoming a bigger and bigger problem because it gets more pushback. You have these sue and settle type things from environmental groups, even for areas that use a lot of gas. So that's a concern. But a lot of this area, like I said, if we're not totally dependent on the price of oil like it is down in Texas. But I do think if you look at the amount of reserves that we have here, great potential. In this year, Texas has declined in gas production because it's associated gas that you get from oil. There's been a lot of lower amount of oil drilling, so you get less associated gas. Here in Appalachia, we've actually been flat. We produce about 32, 33 BCF per day, which is probably around double what Canada produces overall. So we still produce a ton. It's been a flat year, but these states need our gas. I mean, that's the bottom line of it. It gets continually forgotten. I use Florida, the example. Florida is the greatest example. It's a growing state. You saw how important it was in the election. Florida this year, and I know these numbers off the top of my head, for the first 6 months of this year, used gas for 76% of its electricity came from natural gas this year. And Florida is not a producer, they're an importer. So the areas around here in my area, they're increasingly using gas. We produce it. The problem with these pipeline blocking is that it doesn't change the need for the product. It only makes it harder to get. We've seen this in New England, the blocking pipelines. It doesn't lower demand. It just makes the product more expensive. And that's really unfortunate because low cost energy is essential, not just here, but in the whole world, of course.
How can we help in messaging, Jude? Like, what can we do to, like, I completely agree with this. And I want to end our conversation on where we started on, you know, what's the opportunities and what are the pathways to North American energy security?
Well, first, let me hit on that last point. I think the pathways is something like a NAFTA 2.0, like we've seen. I'll be very curious to see where this goes under a different administration, USMCA. I thought that was a great, you know, this is the greatest potential energy partnership. And like I said, it's not just oil and gas. You said it best. It's all the above. It's about energy. Energy is good. And that's why I don't want the oil and gas people coming out and not liking solar, not liking wind. That's just the wrong approach. We've got to be pro reducing emissions, pro energy. And that to me is the greatest thing that we have in Canada. When you talk about oil, and I forgot to mention this, Canada, and I wrote an article many years ago, it was called the Canadian oil sands, the North America's great energy security blanket. I wrote it like 5 or 6 years ago. And 180 billion barrels of proven oil Canada has, and I've mentioned they have a growing export complex. How could we utilize that in an environmentally responsible manner? Because again, we're talking jobs, and you're not just talking jobs, you're talking high-paying jobs. The oil and gas industry has, the pipeline industry, huge paying, high-paying jobs, benefits for everybody. And I think the Biden administration will understand that, working with Trudeau and some other leadership, hopefully. And you're seeing it in Canada. There's been a little bit of working together on different sides. It isn't all doom and gloom overall, but I think this, we really have to get this right when you look at China, the buyer, working with Russia. You look at India, the buyer, working with the supplier of Iran. This is a totally North American security issue, national security issue. We're friends and allies. We have to get this together. And to me, I worry about Mexico. That's another podcast probably, but I want Mexico to be part of this as well because they have a young population, they have a growing population, they have a lot of energy needs, they have a lot of energy. They need our help exploiting it, not just oil, gas, but wind and solar. Mexico has a ton of solar opportunity. So that what it is, I don't like people coming out and being against anything. We need to be pro-energy, pro-economic development in a clean, sustainable way. And I think that is occurring in the industry. I think they've come to that realization.
Well, I think that's a good place to end. And I agree. We're going to have Jude back on here and we'll talk about, take it deeper into the, because we can't leave Mexico behind here. Isn't right. Like, it's just not right because it's right there. And it's.
Yeah. My wife would not like that. That's for sure.
No, it's not, my son's partner wouldn't like it either. And, So let's end there. Jude, thanks so much for participating. I know we're a small think tank in Calgary and Ottawa, but we punch above our weight, and we really appreciate your effort to help us out today, and we're going to look forward to future discussions of global energy security. I've got one last question. What are you reading these days?
I was actually reading a book on Gene Tunney, if you can believe it, the legendary boxer from the 1920s. But what I do is I read a lot of oil price. I do a lot of Forbes, and I've been reading the ESG stuff, environmental, social governance. LNG is always big. And the stuff that I've been reading, you know, oil prices, what's going to happen with oil under a different administration. We could see a flood of supply coming from Venezuela and Iran if sanctions are lifted. They're just waiting to unload some oil, things like that. But I've been doing a little bit more ESG reading on how the industry can react to some of the pushback they're getting from banks, like in hedge funds, like BlackRock and other companies that are pushing back to sort of monitor their impact on climate. I think that is something that has been installed in the industry right now.
That's a very good point. And it seems like the money managers, they find the path of least resistance because that's what where they can get their bid. That's the discussion for another day too. When you're talking about sports biographies, I'm looking in my library here. If you like sports biographies,
absolutely.
When Pride Still Mattered by David Marianis, the biography of Vince Lombardi. It's an
outstanding. Oh, nice. I'll definitely have to check it out. Yeah. Thank you guys so much. I appreciate any time. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Energy Security Cubed on the Canadian Global Affairs Podcast Network. You can find the CGI Network on iTunes, Spotify, and Google Play. If you like the show, give us a rating. You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn. If you like this episode and want to help us keep creating content, you can support us by donating at www.cgai.ca/support. The Energy Security Cubed is brought to you by our team at CGAI. Thanks go out to our producers, Seth Scott and Charlotte Duval-Lentoine, and to Drew Phillips for providing our music. I'm Kelly Ogle. Thanks for joining us on Energy Security Cubed.